You're listening to Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and Friends, the number one source for travel news, reviews, and in-depth travel journalism, broadcasting live from Florida's Sun Coast on the Travel Talk Radio Network. Don't forget, you can listen to us online 24/7 at ttrn.com. And now, here's the travel guy, Roy Lowy.
Thank you, Scott. And yes, this is the travel guy, Roy Lowy, with another great travel show in sunny Florida. My guests today are Evan Eggers, president of O2Cruise.com, Kimberly Riley, Lake Placid Visitors Bureau, Carol Matthews on My Own in Amsterdam, Brian Matthews, Dinosaurs in Alberta, and Destination Worldview with Bob Fisher, who's going to take us to Madrid. Evan Eggers, president of O2Cruise.com, is on the line. And good morning, Evan.
Good morning, Roy.
You're back, and everything is wonderful.
Oh, yeah, everything is good. It's, you know, it's those of us in the travel business are all kind of settling in, getting our houses in order, ready for the tidal wave of bookings that usually results in January when people come back from their holidays and start booking travel like crazy. So we're just all getting ready.
Right. Let's just go to what's happening in the cruise business.
Well, we've got a few interesting things. I mean, in just interesting tidbits, news briefs. Carnival has been very happy with the performance of the cruise ship Celebration out of Jacksonville. So they're going to be sticking around there for another 2 years at least through November of 2007, which I think everybody, they're the only cruise ship that's homeported there, so I'm sure they're delighted to keep it. And that's nice that that's worked out for both Jacksonville and Carnival. So people who live in that area, there's your ship.
There are a number of other things happening, and one which you happened to mention in an email to me was about the Cubans that were rescued by the Celebrity.
Yeah, that's right. And earlier, a few weeks ago, we reported that in November that the Celebrity Zenith picked up 10 Cubans from a boat that was not doing well, not too far off the coast of Cuba. And of those 10 people who were rescued, 9 of them in the end were sent back to Cuba under the U.S.'s wet feet, dry feet policy. The people who actually, Cubans who actually make it to U.S. shores on their own boat are usually allowed to stay, and those who don't are sent back. That's exactly what happened in this case, with the exception being that one of the 10 people has not been sent back, and the government hasn't said why. So presumably they were able to make some kind of a case that they should be allowed to stay. So
now they also, there was an interesting bit about Carnival and what's the fellow's name from the... the founder of EasyJet, which is Easy Cruise, I guess he calls it.
You're not going to try and make me pronounce his last name, are you? He goes. Fortunately for all of us, he goes by his first name, Stelios. he figures that he only needs to have one name. Stelios does, and yeah, this is kind of humorous. So Easy Cruise has started sailing in the Caribbean. This is a new startup cruise line with a fellow who did EasyJet, which is kind of like it's a low fare airline that serves Europe. And this guy is a serial entrepreneur. Now, the Easy Cruise 1 is their ship. It's not at all like a regular cruise ship. There's no real entertainment on board. The cabins are all inside. They're tiny. Everything's painted bright orange. If you want food, you pay for it. If you want your stateroom cleaned, you pay for it. Everything, you pay for. But by the same token, you can hop on and hop off the ship. You don't need to book a full 7 days or 14 days or whatever. So Stelios went and sailed on a Costa vessel and was interviewed walking around the Costa vessel and actually referred to the decor as tacky. Well, Mickey Arison, who's the chairman of Carnival Cruise Lines, got wind of this, and apparently they started sending emails back and forth to each other. Mickey Arison pointed out something along the lines of, if anybody would know what tacky is, it would certainly be the man who's responsible for a bright orange cruise ship. So this has been going back and forth, and now the last salvo in this battle is that Stelios is running an Easy Cruise ad in the Miami paper, of course, right in Carnival's backyard to really stick his finger in their eye, that basically was quoted as saying that the ad says, if spending nights at sea in tacky ballrooms full of old folks is your idea, not your idea of a holiday, then Easy Cruise is for you, and any similarity with Carnival is purely coincidental. So it's always fun seeing very, very wealthy people mix it up like this, I'd say.
I see that Clear's reports are in. We had kind of touched on that last time of what the numbers were, but the numbers are in, and they looked really good, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. CLIA says, CLIA, of course, which is Cruise Lines International Association, and they represent just about all the cruise lines that serve the U.S. market, reported 6% growth in the third quarter of this year versus the third quarter of last year, which works out to over 3 million guests sailed in the quarter. So, you know, it's on track to be another record year for the cruise industry, which makes me happy naturally.
What other interesting tidbit do you have?
Well, let's see. People may remember last year that Celebrity Cruises, which is differentiating itself as a really, you know, premium and unusual experience, had done a contract with Cirque du Soleil. And they were offering a Cirque du Soleil experience on board in one of the heavily themed lounge, but it wasn't a show, and people were disappointed in that, so they kind of pulled it off the table, but now they've reintroduced it on Summit and Constellation, where six Cirque performers actually do perform a 40-minute show, which is more what the customers were expecting when they heard that Cirque was going to be on board these ships. And then in addition, they've made it kind of a festive evening that before the shows, on the evenings when the Cirque performers will be doing their thing, they have a white knights party in this lounge at the edge of the bar at the edge of the earth where they encourage everyone to dress in white. They have all the performers there. They do lots of, you know, interesting theme things in the bar just to kind of make the whole evening a festive event around Cirque. But the big news is that there actually is a Cirque performance on board the ships now, which is, you know, I think will serve very well. And that's gotten good reviews.
Well, that's good news. And, Evan, we've got to run. Thank you once again. And I think next week we're going to take a break because we've got the Christmas week, so we won't be back until the 28th. And we wish you a happy holiday, and we hope to be talking to you soon.
Same to you. Thanks a lot, Roy.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
That was Evan Eggers of O2Cruise.com, and we're going to go to break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Kimberly Riley from Lake Placid.
Introducing the new Total All-Inclusive Club Med with unlimited drinks, all-day dining, world-class accommodations, 64 sports and activities, all gratuities and more for a totally great price. So you can totally forget your wallet. Call today for a totally unlimited, totally together, totally barefoot time. Book now and save on a 7-night total all-inclusive vacation to Club Med in the Caribbean, Bahamas, or Mexico. Call today. You'll totally want to do it again. Oh, yeah.
Sugar.
Well, how many of you out there saw Ice 2005 on NBC Sunday night? Can I see a raise of hands? One, two, three. And those way in the back? Well, that's very good, because today we have a very special lady by the name of Kimberly Riley, who is the Director of Communications for the Lake Placid Visitors Bureau, and about to join us, and we can chat with her about that in Essex County in general. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Roy. How are you?
I'm terrific. We're having a little technical problem with coming sound. If you can talk up a little bit, let me just experiment here a little bit. Are you still with us, Kim?
I'm with you.
Okay, fine. First of all, let's just touch a little bit on ICE as we saw it on NBC. Could you just give us a little bit about what kind of events they were?
Well, the program was hosted in Lake Placid, and it featured different winter sports that included bobsled, luge, skeleton. I don't know if you're familiar with all of these.
Well, certainly not skeleton.
That's a head-first situation.
Well, we saw one head-first come right out of one of the bobsleds, actually. Well, not head-first, but feet-first.
Oh, really? That's the luge. And curling, luge, bobsled, and skeleton were the four sports that were featured on the broadcast, which was held, it was broadcast both Saturday and Sunday last weekend. And since it was hosted in Lake Placid, we got a lot of coverage out of that, although the bobsled was the only event that was actually took place here in Lake Placid at our Verizon Sports Complex. It was great exposure for the area. I guess 13 million people watched the show, according to the ratings so far.
Well, you have a number of events up there, actually, don't you? You do one of the equestrian programs. You have 2 weeks of that, I believe.
Right, there's two weeks in the summertime. Our largest and biggest multi-day event is the Lake Placid Horse Shows and the I Love New York Horse Shows. It's actually two events, and they've been happening here for 36 years. It's common for people to associate Lake Placid and the Adirondacks with winter sports, but it's actually we welcome more visitors in the summer than we do in the winter.
That's interesting, because when one thinks of Lake Placid, one thinks of winter sports, but it makes a lot of sense, because just tell us some of the summer stuff.
Well, obviously, Lake Placid's right smack in the middle of the high peaks of the Adirondack Park,
right,
which is a 6-million-acre state park, which is the largest state park in the lower 48 states. And as such, we have the Olympic venues, which are actually open to the public year-round, and some of them are visitors can ride the luge and the bobsled and watch some of the action from the sidelines as well. But in addition to that, just being in the pristine Adirondack mountains and lakes, there's it's an outdoor recreation paradise, so to speak. Kayaking, hiking, biking, all of the outdoor pursuits that are so popular these days, especially the more extreme rock climbing. And have you done that, Roy?
I know a little. That's a tricky question, Kim. I got caught up with a little. Well, I wouldn't say mountain climbing, but certainly some hiking through some pretty hectic trails.
Yes, and we certainly have that. There are 46 high peaks, and there's people strive to become something they call the 46er club by climbing all 46 of the high peaks that are over 4,000 feet in elevation. So
And I was going to say, you also have something called Gold for the Green.
Yes, actually, that's something that, because we are situated in the Adirondacks, we promote the use of hybrid technology to sort of enhance our clean, green, environmental responsibility here in the Adirondack Park. And as such, the Visitors Bureau is promoting the use of hybrid cars, and if you drive, we're a two-time Olympic host city in 1932 and 1980. So if you drive your hybrid car to our office here at the Olympic Center, we'll award you with a souvenir gold medal.
Oh, how nice!
Which is kind of it's been well received promotion to sort of promote the fact that the Adirondacks are a green, environmentally friendly, and showcase our leadership as far as regenerative technology.
That's great, and that's good fun, and great for the environment. Now, from what I see, you get an average winter snowfall in Lake Placid of about 133 inches.
That's
a lot of snow.
It is, yes.
Well, I guess you only know that when you're shoveling your driveway.
Yes, repeatedly. and again, we have plows for that as well. We welcome the snow. If it's cold, we may as well have snow here, because we want to play in it. We do have alpine and cross-country skiing and snowshoeing and all of those things going on here, in addition to the ice that people slide down on the luge and bobsled and skeleton. So we say bring it on. we're hoping that's on the low end of how much snow we get this year. We're already skiing. So
my lord, on the low end, I can't believe that. Good lord,
you have to embrace it.
Well, listen, when you're in it, you love it. When you're away from it, you forget about it, I guess. And
yeah.
I went down to 43 degrees here this morning, and I had to get out my Bunsen burner to get warm.
It was 10 below this morning when I woke up.
10 below. My
yes.
Gosh. Now, the website is lakeplacid.com.
That's correct.
And it's Kimberly Riley we're speaking with. And, Kimberly, we thank you, because we've got to take a break.
Okay.
And we hope to chat with you soon about Lake Placid.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh.
For now.
USA 3000 Airlines knows the way. USA 3000 now flies to and from Fort Myers,
St. Petersburg, Clearwater, and Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, servicing 11 different cities, all at our same low fares starting at $59. No peanuts served here. For a low fare with a real meal and in-flight entertainment, choose USA 3000. USA 3000 has simple fare rules regardless of the fare. There are no Saturday night stays and no round trip required on any fare. They have a low change fee, and this is the part you're really going to love. Even if you miss your flight, you don't lose your fare. So what are you waiting for? With fares this low and rules this simple, you can afford to take someone with you. Call now to make your reservations at 1-877-USA-3000. That's 1-877-USA-3000. You can also book online at www.usa3000.com or call your local travel agent.
I'm a traveling man, made a lot of stuff all over the world, and in every port I own the heart of at least one lovely girl. I've a pretty señorita waiting.
Well, we're back, and we're joined by travel journalist Carol Matthews, and Carol's going to share a grassroots article titled On My Own in Amsterdam. Good morning, Carol.
Hello, Roy.
I kind of lost you there for a little bit, but you were quick to get us back. That's terrific. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Let me just quote a little something from your article, and you say, I'm a 53-year-old married woman visiting this European city on my own, so what am I doing walking around the streets of Amsterdam alone? This, after all, is a city of acceptance, legal marijuana, and the famous red light district. Well, to be completely candid, I'm having a ball.
Yes.
What a great line.
It's a beautiful city. It's a wonderful city, and I know that a lot of people just think of it as an accepting city. It's open to all kinds of new ideas and experiences, and with the red light district and the marijuana and this sort of thing. But it's a lot more than that. It's a beautiful city. The people are friendly, and I had a wonderful time.
Well, apparently you got around quite well, and you mentioned a number of things that I find interesting. One is walking and bicycling, and I always find walking around and finding my way around, even though you said, well, you know, I got lost doing it, but it was a nice way to get lost.
Absolutely. And I don't know, I mentioned in the story also that I'm directionally challenged, and I didn't think I was, but Amsterdam really put me in my place as far as everything seemed backwards to me on the map. But it was all there, and it was a challenge to find your way around, though, because even though the maps were quite good, a lot of the little walkways, the alleyways, weren't listed, or I could find the name on the map, but I couldn't find the name on the canal or the street. There, I couldn't find any name, so it was interesting.
Well, because first of all, you said that they speak English. But
yes.
There weren't. Most of the signs were not in English.
Absolutely, yes. The English speaking was no problem at all. All the shopkeepers, all the tram drivers, everywhere I went, you could speak easily in English. But you couldn't read anything, unless you knew Dutch.
Right, right. And so you walked around, and what'd you find?
Well, it is an easy city to walk in, and it's flat, of course, because it is the Netherlands. It's reclaimed from the ocean, so there's no hills to climb. You can walk for miles, and you don't really get tired.
And, of course, at this point, you'd said that you were jet-lagged, induced slumber, and forced myself to start exploring.
Well, I did. I had no plans. This was my first trip to continental Europe. And I realize I'm late in life starting to travel the world, but I was wondering. I had no idea what to expect. I traveled overnight on the flight. I didn't sleep that well, so although I got into the city at 9 o'clock in the morning, I was totally exhausted, and I thought, well, I'll just sit for a few minutes in my hotel room And I woke up, what, 3.5 hours later, I think.
And the whole world changed.
Exactly. And I knew I had to get out because I was losing minutes of, you know, sleeping. And that's no way to spend your time. But so, yes, everything was quiet when I went in at 9 o'clock when I came out. The whole world had changed. The people were everywhere. There was music playing. It was beautiful.
Well, and you said, which I find interesting, at 2:30 p.m. on Friday, the public area in front of your hotel had been transformed into this whole, the whole people had come to the restaurants, the sidewalk cafes, and life just started early in the afternoon.
Exactly. And I shouldn't admit this, but I'm not a party girl.
Okay? Oh, Carol.
And and I wasn't expecting any of this. So here I come out, and it was great. What caught me off guard or was different in my eyes was, you know, in North America, there's lots of outdoor patios, and everybody sits around the table and chats with each other and drinks. But outside here, the chairs were all set up in lines facing the street, and everybody was people watching. And there were also some musicians there. There was a violinist who was serenading everyone, just walking around. It was very romantic.
And friendly.
Very friendly, yes. I had to ask directions over and over and over again, and everyone was so helpful and so kind and so happy to do it. It was great.
So you wandered. Well, I think at first you said did you take a bus trip around?
I took a canal tour.
A canal tour.
I had to catch my bus to the hotel.
Right. Well, you know, I always find when one goes to a city, because you compare Amsterdam a little bit to London, and I always find you go to a city, whether it's a bus or in this case, of course, a canal tour would be more effective. At least you get the feel of the city. You get to see what it looks like, and then when you walk, maybe one doesn't get so lost.
Exactly. No, it was great because the canals are sort of laid out in arches, and the old city is almost like in the shape of a horseshoe. And the three main canals, and I can't remember the names of them, I'm sorry, at the moment, they're enclosed in this horseshoe. One is smaller, bigger, and the biggest. So everything really that a visitor wants to see is located in that area. So once you had taken the canal tour, and it's a wonderful perspective, you see things from a totally different way than you do when you're walking, and you can seem to get places that you can't find as easily when you're walking as well.
And you interestingly say that getting lost becomes a habit, and an effective one as well, because I eventually come across everything that I wanted to see.
Well, that's it. Yeah, I never ended up going where I planned to go, but I always ended up somewhere I wanted to be.
Wonderful.
So it was fun.
Now, tell us about, everyone wants to hear about the flowered laden houseboats.
Oh, that's amazing. Actually, the houseboats, they went from decrepit to almost, you know, palatial in a sense, but everyone had flowers on their houseboat. They're tied up along the canals, and some even had gardens. There was a vegetable garden on one. They had them all done in pots, but people on the weekend, like after I arrived on a Friday, so Saturday, Sunday, people would be sitting out on the deck of their houseboat in the sun with flowers all around them. It was fascinating.
And you say that, of course. Tell us a little bit more about, I kind of jumped around here a little bit, on the canal boat tour, because you say essentially the city is floating, and so give us a little feel for that.
Yes. Growing up, you know, you study about the Netherlands, and you realize that Holland is all reclaimed from the sea. In my North American frame of mind, I could see them, you know, trucking in loads of dirt and filling it in, but that's not what it is at all. They've reclaimed it, but what they've done is they've built all their buildings on stilts or pylons, and most of Amsterdam itself has to go through about 30 meters of peat moss water to get to the hard soil, the sand below, so they can anchor these buildings. So the city, in a sense, is floating, and then the canals are the open areas, the natural areas in between.
Right, and you say that the water is about 2 to 3 meters deep, but it's fresh, but not suitable for swimming.
Well, no, it's been, it's much like...
like a normal canal we'd see here through in Florida in some respects.
Exactly, yes. It's used for a lot of different things. Boating, sometimes for garbage, but you didn't see any. But it's just that, you know, it's, no one swam.
So you wandered around and you checked out the canals, and then where did you head? I would guess museums.
Yes, museums. The museums there are wonderful. I especially like the Van Gogh Museum because it depicted his whole life through his paintings, and I like his art because it tells the story of the peasants and the people in his time. Also, the Rijksmuseum had a wonderful display of Rembrandt. And Rembrandt, the 400th anniversary of his birth is coming up in 2006, so they were building up to it at that point, and they had a wonderful display there.
Yeah, I think this coming year is going to be very interesting. I think it'll be a lot of fun to get over there, because with this great celebration, it should be just lovely. Now, you did say that aside from the museums, you took a little walk through the red light district, is that correct?
Oh, yes. That was, I put it off and put it off, and I thought, you know, that's really, I don't know if I feel comfortable. But towards the end of I was there for a week, and I thought, I cannot come to Amsterdam without going through the red light district. So I did walk through about 9 or 10 o'clock one morning during the week, and it was fascinating. I know I overuse that word, but really, it's just, there are streets with large, almost like picture windows in the front, and they're fringed usually with red. There are some colored lights inside. And what the women do is they stand, sit, or dance in these windows and, you know, invite people to come in and enjoy some time with them.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
At 9 o'clock in the morning, I only saw one lady selling her wares. So, but I'm glad I went.
Well, that's good. It just, you know, you just after that though, I would think that you probably stayed away from your hotel window.
Good point.
Now, after going to the red light district, tell us a little bit about the Amsterdam Botanical Gardens, because I understand you went there from the article.
Oh yes, and as you know, I'm a garden nut, and the Amsterdam Botanical Garden is a lovely garden. It's right in the middle of the city. It has thousands and thousands of plants and trees and flowers, and most of them were brought back to Amsterdam when the Dutch had colonies in Indonesia and the Antilles.
Yeah, I found that very interesting, yeah.
Yes, and they have been maintained all that time. And just like other botanical gardens in Europe, I mean, everything is named, of course, so people can learn about them. But they're also a respite in the middle of the city. People can go there. You feel like you're in a totally different world. Things were all fully in bloom. I was there in May. So actually the tulips had pretty much gone, except for the ones specifically for sale. But the rest of the gardens were coming into bloom. Something else I want to talk about before we run out of time is the Stendal Canal, where they have the barges and street vendors selling plants and flowers. And actually what it is, a century ago, the barges would come in from the country and tie up along next to the streets in the, you know, beside the canals and sell their flowers there. Now the barges are permanently there, and of course the trucks bring the flowers in from the country. But it's wonderful. There's a whole canal lined with all of these different barges. They sell everything from bulbs to tulips to roses to anything you can imagine, and the colors and the fragrance are amazing.
Wonderful. And for those listening, there are links to a number of different websites on with Carol's article, which is on our website, ttrn.com. And I found one this morning. It's called flyamsterdam.com. And they have some special packages for 2006 Rembrandt celebration. So one might want to check that out as well. Carol, always a pleasure. We're going to go to break, and when we come back, we're going to be chatting with a fellow by the name of, let me just work that one out, Brian Matthews.
Yes, yes.
And he's going to take us on a Jurassic journey, dinosaurs in Alberta, Canada. So stay tuned. We're just going to break, and we'll be right back.
Bye-bye, Roy.
Bye, Carol.
Totally gone native. Totally playful. Totally never tried that before. Totally Club Med. Introducing the new Total All-Inclusive Club Med with unlimited drinks. All-day dining, world-class accommodations, 64 sports and activities, all gratuities and more for a totally great price. So you can totally forget your wallet. Call today for a totally unlimited, totally together, totally barefoot time. Book now and save on a 7-night total all-inclusive vacation to Club Med in the Caribbean, Bahamas, or Mexico. Call today. You'll totally want to do it again. Oh, yeah.
I'm a traveling man, made a lot of stuff.
And we're back, and we're going to be joined by Brian Matthews, who is a traveling man, and he's our traveling fossils man. I don't know if that sounds right, but anyway, he's our fossils reporter, and he's joining us this morning, and the subject today is dinosaurs in Alberta. And we're speaking about fossils, of course, because it's been some time since one has roamed Alberta. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Roy. It's good to talk to you again.
And you, my friend. Why Alberta, Canada? Take us then.
Alberta is one of the richest repositories. I call it a repository. It's one of the richest places where you can find dinosaur fossils in the world. It's got a great variety, and it's just got a great magnitude of them. And, you know, I talk about the Badlands in particular, where you can walk through these Badlands, and almost anybody with a sharp eye can possibly spot a dinosaur fossil.
Well, you know, that's interesting because you start your article off by saying, as we know, dinosaurs fascinate children and adults alike, and it's an ancient form of animal life that became extinct 65 million years ago. Now, that's hard to comprehend, and that now they're fossilized, and life forms have been a major reason why these professionals and amateurs travel to Alberta. And so I found it sort of amazing that Alberta was such a big source of these fossils.
Well, it has to do an awful lot with the geology. You know, when I take a look at the website from the Royal Tyrrell Museum and Dinosaur Provincial Park, which are two of the most prominent areas in Alberta, they've got some great explanations there. But it talks about the fact that you know, there were a lot of rivers flowing through this area, which was fairly tropical in nature. There was a lot of warmth at that time. They left these rivers that flowed through, left a lot of sand and mud deposits. They make up the valley walls. Then came along the Ice Age and erosion over the years, which have sculpted out, if you want, the cliffs and the coulees. And the coulee is a French name for a ravine. And so as a result of that, a lot of the geology has remained intact, with the exception of the Ice Age, which has caused some of the erosion. But the fossils have basically just laid there for 65 million years. So there's been nothing like volcanoes or earthquakes, that sort of thing, like you have in other parts of the world, such as Nova Scotia, where everything's all fractured. So you've got these, if you look at the Badlands, you can almost see it like a layered cake, where it's got a layer of sandstone, it'll have a layer of some other Cretaceous rock, and then you'll see the areas that might have the fossils preserved in them. And they're all just flat.
And amazing saying that you can walk around the corner of a ravine and find what looked like a shiny piece of rock sticking out from the face of a cliff, and what you've really found is the tip of a serrated tooth of a meat-eating dinosaur.
That's my own personal experience. That happened 3 years ago.
Incredible.
And it was just a highlight of my fossil collecting journey.
Now, what type of dinosaur would that be?
Well, I suspect it was
It was definitely a Tyrannosaurid, meaning it was a meat-eating dinosaur, not necessarily a Tyrannosaurus rex, probably wasn't. One of the larger dinosaurs out there that is most prevalent is called an Albertosaurus, named after the province.
Right. Amazing.
The variations in the teeth were still very, very evident. It was just like looking at a small steak knife.
So, in this process, you wander around, obviously, in some cases on your own, in this Badlands, as you call it. But the interesting thing that I found is that they have these Badlands science camps. Tell us about those.
Well, these are an evolution of previous programs that have run at the Royal Tyrrell Museum. That used to be called Field Experience, and that's how I started my program. But I was really pleased to see that they've got these Badlands science camps, which are really for children and families. And when I say children, as early as age 9 to 11, could go on what's called a junior adventure camp. It's a 7-day overnight camp. You'll stay in a teepee that's been erected by the Royal Tyrrell Museum. You'll work on site with the museum staff. You'll perhaps work in this case, in the junior camp, you'll work in a simulated dinosaur quarry. They'll already have put some pieces around, and you'll be able to reassemble them. You'll be able to discover them. You'll be able to find out what they were, what the skeleton would have looked like. The scientists will be right, and the staff will be right on site with you to help you identify them and to answer all your questions. Really practical, hands-on stuff for kids.
So it's 9 to 11,
right.
12 to 14, which is another grouping, and, of course, adults.
Right, and in the 12 to 14 group, now they do a little more adventuresome stuff. They're actually going out into the Badlands and actually looking for fossils as opposed to a simulated quarry. It's going to be in, not necessarily a real quarry, but they'll be prospecting and looking. What's really interesting, most of the finds of fossils have been found probably by amateurs. A lot of those amateurs happen to be children. They're close to the ground, they're looking, they're able to see, as long as you can teach them what it is they might be looking for, and they're really curious. So they don't just overlook things like an adult might.
Right, and they have more patience.
That's right. Well, I don't know about that.
In some cases.
It takes some patience.
Yeah, if they're focused, they have patience. So now, tell us a little bit more about the camps, because I found that really fascinating. With the 9 to 11s, where do they stay in these junior camps? Where are those located?
They're going to be, I'm not sure exactly what the location is, but they will be close to the museum itself. That's the Royal Tyrrell Museum. They'll
right.
be probably within, you know, a half an hour hiking distance.
So it's like it's a day trip for them.
Well, it's a morning hike, but they actually stay for a whole week if they want to.
Right, but in like hotel facilities.
Well, in these teepees.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that. The teepees.
Oh, yeah. No, they'll be staying right in the overnight in the camp.
Because I noticed on the other ones, they're actually staying in tents somewhere.
Right. Those would be just a little further off-site.
Yeah, those would be the 12 to 14 range.
That's right, because they've got to get those young people out into an environment where they're apt to find something.
Now,
everything close around the museum has already been prospected quite severely.
Yeah, I would think, yeah. Now, so you've actually attended 5 of these sessions.
I have. Mine were called Field Experiences, which were definitely much more remote. We stayed in tent camps that we brought our own tents and sleeping bags along, any clothes that we needed for a whole week, including some rain gear and lots of sunscreen. Pretty hot out there, a good hat.
And you went to really remote areas.
Oh, yeah. We would be, you know, even if we tented in a farmer's farmyard, which would have been a summer farm for them, they wouldn't have lived there, wouldn't have had any facilities available, would have had a cookhouse that would have been brought in by the museum itself. We would have cooked our own meals, participated fully in camp life, and then perhaps driven a half an hour right into the Badlands to get to the site that we'd be working on.
Which you call bone beds, is that what you call them?
That's right. A bone bed is just a collection of bones. It could be from several animals that have fossilized and lain in one area collectively.
And you further go on to say that southern Alberta has possibly the richest collection of dinosaur bones in the world. That's pretty amazing.
Well, it is. You can find fossils, and I maintain this. You'll find fossils anywhere where you'll find the proper age of rock, and that's one of the things about Alberta. The age of the rock is somewhere between 65 million and 235 million years old, which is really the dinosaur period. And,
now, the scientists that have been out there for some time, over a long period of time, how many complete dinosaurs would you say that they've discovered, or skeletons, you know, complete dinosaur skeletons?
Well, I think they've got in total maybe somewhere around 150 complete skeletons.
Hmm.
That means they found it mostly from the tip of the tail right up to the nose.
So it's the sort of thing that that we've seen in various museums, or, you know, in other parts of the country.
That's right, and a lot of skeletons have actually been cast into molds, reproduced so that they could be shared with other museums. Because once a skeleton is found, it is fairly rare to find an intact skeleton, and in order for other places to share in that and be able to have the benefit of them on their site, they make casts, molds, sell them to these museums or loan them to them.
Right. Now, you point out an interesting thing. It's called voluntourism and family travel. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the way I view it was, when I was going out on the field experiences, I used to pay money to go, the same as you will if you go in these camps. The prices are on the web page for the Royal Tyrrell Museum.
Right, which are at the bottom of your article. We've got links to all of those. Yeah.
But you know, any money that I would have paid, or any money that these families are paying, are going not only to cover their own costs while they're on site, but they're going to support students who might be in the field working, trying to further their education so that they could be paleontologists in the future. And so the money that we spend actually goes to support museum, not just the staff itself, but their own research that they might not be able to afford to do on other terms. So that's where the voluntourism comes into it.
Now, is this a fairly new concept? Because the word is unfamiliar to me.
Well, they've been doing it in at the Royal Tyrrell Museum, probably for about 15 years in total.
Okay.
It probably wasn't very well known, because they could never house that many people, never take that many people on a particular summer. It might only have perhaps upwards of 40 or 50 people. I can remember when these things used to come on the website to make the announcement that they were available, they'd be gone within a week or 2 weeks. If you didn't get your name in there early, they were gone. So
yeah, there wasn't,
only exposing 40 or 50 people a year.
Right. Well, it's very interesting, and there's some interesting links on our website at the bottom of Brian's article, and I find it fascinating, because it's first of all, to me, when I think of Alberta, it's a beautiful place, but I don't think about dinosaurs, and I'm sure there are a lot of people listening that would be very interested in following up on that. So, Brian, I thank you very much. Another great report, and we look forward to talking to you soon.
Thanks, Roy. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Bye for now.
Bye.
Well, that was Brian Matthews, and we're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Associate Producer Mr. Bob Fisher, and we're going to chat a bit about some things happening in Madrid.
USA 3000 Airlines knows the way. USA 3000 now flies to and from Fort Myers, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, and Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, servicing 11 different cities, all at our same low fares starting at $59. No peanuts served here. For a low fare with a real meal and in-flight entertainment, choose USA 3000. USA 3000 has simple fare rules regardless of the fare. There are no Saturday night stays and no round trip required on any fare. They have a low change fee, and this is the part you're really going to love. Even if you miss your flight, you don't lose your fare. So what are you waiting for? With fares this low and rules this simple, you can afford to take someone with you. Call now to make your reservations at 1-877-USA-3000. That's 1-877-USA-3000. You can also book online at www.usa3000.com or call your local travel agent.
Well, we're back, and we're joined by associate producer Mr. Bob Fisher, who's going to take us on another destination worldview. And Bob's going to go into we're going to take us into Madrid, and the article is called "Art Meets Innocence in Madrid." Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing terrific. It went from 43, it's now up to 75, so we're all right.
Well, that's okay, because I'm just basking in minus 10 here.
Well, you know, we talked to Kimberly Riley, and that's where she was at, minus 10, so.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway.
I loved what, you know, I want to get to Lake Placid. I haven't been there in many years.
Yeah, I'd love
great
to.
Great with all the,
I'd love to
you know,
do that
winter
well.
Activities really are fun activities.
Yeah, there's some great stuff, and it's interesting. They have I know you're into horses, and they have they have one of those events, as a 2-week event, in fact, which has been going on for a long time. Bob, interesting article, a marvelous article actually. But tell us a little bit about what this article is really about.
Well, yeah, I have to give you a little background. This was, I would call this a micro-travel experience. For me, it was a moment in time. And it was a moment in time in many points of view. I should point out that my wife and I were set to go to Madrid to go. I was doing an article in Spain, the lower part of Spain, the southern part of Spain. Unfortunately, we were to fly on September the 11th, and like so many millions of people, you know, our plans, of course, changed. We went a month later and did the trip. What this article really is about, what it was for me, was a moment of hope as well. It takes place, and I'll explain for the people that are listening, there is a wonderful museum in Madrid called the Thyssen-Bornemisza Museum, and if you go to the article on the website, you'll get the direct link to, so I won't try spelling that word. But it's a very unique, smaller museum that is actually a renovated royal palace. And it has a collection of works, everything from early old masters to the 20th century, and worth up to 300 and, well, the renovations for the palace itself were $350 million, but the worth of the art is in the billions, $3 billion.
And you specifically refer to Room 23.
Yeah, and it was just one of those. When I travel, I'm the type of person who likes to observe, to people watch. And Carol was mentioning that in her piece too about people watching, and that is part of the fun of traveling, especially if you're in a new culture. And in museums and art galleries especially, I like to people watch. And the reason I like to do that, because that's what an art gallery and a museum really is. It's a repository of the best of human creativity and vision. And in this particular museum, I was looking at a painting. I came around the corner into this small room, and there were a group of people, adults, about four adults, standing behind a bench. Sitting on the bench were four or five immaculately dressed little Spanish children. And in the corner next to this wonderful painting called The Little Drummer was the docent of the museum, who was giving a lesson to the children on the painting. It was really an introductory lesson on art appreciation. And these kids were 5, 6, 7 at the most. And I stood behind them, and something drew me to it. And I think it probably was, first of all, the peacefulness of this museum, the peacefulness of the moment, and the innocence of these children, but also the painting and the way the woman was talking about and teaching these children about this particular art form.
And in fact, you mentioned that the only thing that brought you to the 21st century was the metal-rimmed glasses.
Yes, exactly. And she was almost herself. She could have stepped out of the painting, one of those paintings. She was a Madonna-like figure. And it's somewhat important, too, that one of the things I noticed that she was pregnant, but she was in the early stages of pregnancy, and this the whole moment, the whole scene was pregnant with possibilities. And the reason I mention November the 11th is because, you know, like everybody else, we were just beginning to recover from that horrible event. And this micro-travel experience, this moment in time, these beautiful children, this moment of an absolute art experience, was the beginning of me personally coming to terms with what had just changed my world, our world. And it was through the medium of art. You well know that I often say that travel is about exploring the diversity of the human experience, whether
exactly.
it's human culture, human behavior, the social principles within a culture that we visit. But while we are exploring the diversity of that human experience, at the same time we're discovering the commonality, the universality of the human experience. And that was what was occurring here. What I was watching was this young, very wise docent in the museum teaching these young children morality, teaching them human responsibility, teaching them that through the medium of the art, that there were very good reasons why we have to learn in societies to communicate well and effectively with each other and get along. And this is where art and storytelling come together, because what she was essentially doing, it was brilliant. She was asking these children to tell the story in their own words of the painting. And the painting, and very briefly, I'll just give your listeners, it's called The Naughty Little Drummer Player.
Right.
And it's a painting of a woman in a very domestic scene in Holland, very Renaissance, and there's a young child, a sister, in a cradle, a newborn, and the little boy has a drum. And obviously he had been playing the drum and been rebuked by his mother because he was waking up the baby. Well, you know, on the one hand, you really feel for the kid because he's got a new drum. He just wants to play the drum. Come on. And, you know, and the mother is kind of scolding him, and he's sort of tearful and saying, and he doesn't really understand what he did wrong. But this is what the woman in the gallery, this is a story within a story, what she was leading these children to do. And she would have them stand up and point at details and say, for example, one little girl would stand up and interpret what the mother was actually doing and what she was saying and how she was saying it. And it really what we try and do as travel journalists. We try to get inside the painting, if you like. We try to get inside the destination and the culture. And we try and hear the story and see the layers of experience. And then we come back and we try and tell our readers and our listeners about that.
Well, and you're saying raising children is something that parents shouldn't have to do alone. Community resources such as museums and art galleries are venues for putting parenting skills into practice.
Yeah, and if I may do a soapbox number here a little bit, as you know, I was a teacher for 32 years, and I believe very strongly in the fact that parents should not have to raise children alone. They should never have to do it alone. We, as members of society, we are all responsible for everybody's children, and that's why. And what I love about so many European countries where art is very much, and museums are very much public venues where parents take their kids. And there are venues in which the children really have an opportunity as well to get the kinds of life experiences that teach them what the human society is really all about. I remember I used to take student groups to Paris, and I remember once taking a group to We took them to the
Louvre
first, yep. And then we took them to the wonderful Musée d'Orsay, which is a museum that is somewhat like the Thyssen-Bornemisza Museum, because it's very contextual. It's created in an old train station. And what we did, my colleague and I, we said to our students, okay, you don't have to do anything in this museum, but what we want you to do is to go in there with us, and we want you to find one thing that really, really impresses you, that really makes you feel something strongly. What we were trying to do is to give them permission to use their own skills, to not say, oh, I've got to follow the tour, and I got to learn this, and da-da-da-da-da, but to just use their own powers of observation. It turned out to be a wonderful technique, because every student came back, not only, of course, with one thing that they absolutely loved, but with many things. And oftentimes, and this is what I have to do, oftentimes it was a detail or some event that was happening in the museum. And this is what I found myself doing, is watching these Spanish people, these Spanish children, listening to this woman, participating with her, interacting with her, telling the story of this great master of Dutch painting. And it was that context that really explained why art galleries and museums and communities are so important. And at the end of the article, you may have noticed I give a series of links.
I was just going to mention that. There are a number of links, yes.
Yeah, favorite small art galleries and museums of mine. And, you know, that in which I think I say very conducive to observing human behavior and moments in time. And I'll give you just another example. In Florida, the Murakami Museum and Gardens in Delray Beach.
Japanese garden, yeah.
Exactly, Japanese. Who would have ever thought there was a Japanese museum and gardens in Florida in Delray Beach?
Exactly.
It's a wonderful place because, in part, the area was developed by immigrant Japanese farmers. But there are many types of museums like this and art galleries around the world. Frequently, you know, I think the average traveler tends to feel overwhelmed by a museum or an art gallery. We somehow are taught to believe that we're not really competent in, you know, unless we have a guide taking us around telling us all 500 details about that painting. Whereas if you simply say to someone, what do you like, you know? What do you see? What do you hear? What do you think's going on in this painting? And that was the woman doing. And then the people really get into it. But it's all about, and what those children were getting in this article was a basic lesson in human psychology. The little boy who was playing his drum, he initially didn't know that he was doing something today we would say inappropriate. But he had to learn in a way that he had to think of his sibling. Of course, we have the whole sibling rivalry thing. And you as a granddad, Roy,
you don't have to announce that worldwide.
You understand this dynamic, and you must see it, especially on family holidays.
Absolutely.
And what is really, and I've seen this happen before, of course, but the using art, especially when traveling, and you don't have to travel far. I mean, I've seen this in New York City, for example, and art galleries and museums are becoming so children-friendly. Actually, it's like Brian, you know, talking about the Terrell Museum in Alberta, very, very much focused on all ages. Whereas in the past, museums and art galleries used to be reserved only for the upper levels in a society. Those people who had a classical education.
Exactly.
In other words, they kind of already knew what was in there. But the new The new state-of-the-art museum and art gallery today is far more democratic. And when you and I were in the Finger Lakes area, for example, and I was in Rochester, and there's a wonderful museum in Rochester called the Museum of Play. And it's a museum all about toys and children's experience and the whole human behavior of play. And there's some wonderful artistic exhibits there. They have archives of all those toys that you and I played with when we were children. But what that particular museum really is the story of of childhood development. And it's wonderful what they have done, just as, and I go back to the docent in the museum in Madrid. What she was really doing was she was respecting the children's ability to appreciate what they saw and felt and intuitively knew was going on. And these are fundamentally adult skills.
And what better time now than during the holidays for parents to get out when you're looking for things to do and visit museums and other places of educational benefit.
Right.
Bob, we've got to run. Okay. Unless you had some last-minute thing you'd like to say.
No, I just think that the ideas that everyone has put forward today all connect. It really is, and it's probably what the holiday season is about, too. It's all about the interconnectedness of human society, and that's a great thing to explore.
Well, it was a super article and very informative, and we always enjoyed chatting with you. So we're going to run for now and look forward to your next visit.
Okay. Talk to you later.
And bye for now, Bob.
Well, Bob Fisher, interesting man and great article. So if you go to our website, you can there's some photos there along with the article on our Destination Worldview. You can always check our program schedule by going to ttrn.com for the latest guest information. And next week, we're going to run a pre-recorded show so we can take a holiday break until the following Wednesday, the 28th of December. And until then, this is Roy Lowy wishing everyone a very Merry Christmas. And we'll talk to you when we come back.
You've been listening to Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and friends on the Travel Talk Radio Network. Visit our website at ttrn.com for complete show archives and interviews with guests like Chris Elliott, Peter Greenberg, Bob Fisher, Johnny Jett, and many other great travel professionals. Don't forget to tune in live every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern for more Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and friends.